had 10 apologists from all over America speaking. We're reducing that this year to 8. Because the comments we got back is people wanted more time to interact with the different speakers. So there'll be 8, which means there will not be 4 reasons to believe speakers. There will only be 2, because we really wanted to involve some of these outside people. But it's people like Gary Habermas and others that will be speaking. So some of the world's leading apologists will be there. We're also limiting each speaker to 30 minutes. And because we got some feedback, especially about the talks that Fuzz and I get, or any of the scientists, they basically say that for lay audiences, about 30 minutes of science is all they can handle. So we do cut it down. They're also encouraging us to build some stories. So, for example, when I speak, I'm going to be sharing some testimonial work. But we are going to be offering a lot more time for Q&A interaction. If you want to learn about it, go to reasons.org. It's right on the home page. You'll see all the speakers, what their topics will be, and when they'll be speaking. And, yeah, it'll be at Pomona First Baptist Church. They just named their church Purpose Church, but it's basically Pomona First Baptist Church. So, but I would encourage you to register, because we are expecting the place to be packed out. So,
when is that again?
Pardon me?
When is that again?
I think it's the second weekend in February, but I'm not positive. And if you go to our website, reasons.org, all the details are there. The times of the different lectures, what the topics are, who's going to be speaking, and also the times you're going to have to interact. By the way, different organizations will have booths there, so you'll be able to talk to people.
That includes lunch on Saturday? Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think lunch is included. So we're going to try to make everything convenient for you. Okay. Well, last week I said I was going to talk to you about why you can thank God for the extinction of certain animals. A lot of people get the idea that extinction is a bad thing. Sometimes extinction is a good thing. And so one of the things we can thank God for is the extinction of the mammoths. And there's a lot of people actually saying we need to bring the mammoths back. And so there's actually efforts to try to make that happen. It's a long shot. But if you're familiar with Jurassic Park, where they brought back the dinosaurs, that's not credible. That's not going to happen. The DNA is way too corrupted over those tens of millions of years. However, there were woolly mammoths walking live across North America as recently as 3,000 years ago. Some say even 2,000 years ago. Certainly 8,000 years ago, there were lots of them. And so where you do find a woolly mammoth that's been flash frozen in ice, in fact, they have found mammoths that were so quickly frozen, they actually had a foot up and they couldn't bring their foot down because of how rapidly they froze. And the food in their stomach is still it's just in the same condition it would have been the second that they got frozen to death. And say, how can that happen? Hey, just go up north, and you'll see how that can happen. My father was raised in Calgary, and he would tell me when I was a child about the Chinooks. And a Chinook is where a warm wind blows in over the prairie in the wintertime, and the temperature jumps up 100 degrees in less than an hour, sometimes less than half an hour. And they tell you about the Chinooks. They don't tell you about the reverse Chinooks. The reverse Chinooks is where the temperature drops 100 degrees in, say, half an hour. And if the temperature drops that fast, you can understand how a creature could literally be frozen in place. And then they're encrusted with a lot of ice afterwards, and that ice is, basically doesn't melt. Then thousands of years later, you can go back and recover that mastodon. And there's actually researchers who are trying to take the DNA out of recently frozen mastodons and try to use that to alter the ovum of, say, an African elephant, a female, and, kind of like surrogate style, give birth to a mammoth. We're not there yet, but the technology is not impossible. But most people think we probably will not be successful in doing that. But what I'm going to be sharing today, maybe it's not such a good idea to bring the woolly mammoths back. So, and this slide here contrasts the difference between an African elephant and a mastodon. By the way, the mastodons were all of different sizes. You had dwarf mastodons, which were much smaller, half the size of the elephants that wander the earth today, but there are some that were a lot bigger than the biggest elephants on the face of the earth today. And that explains why you kind of see them in the north, because if you had a mammoth that size living where elephants live today, it would overheat. In fact, if you notice, the African elephants have these gigantic ears. Those gigantic ears are basically cooling systems. You'll notice that the elephant will be flapping the ears. There's a lot of blood going up into those ear flaps, and that's kind of the air conditioning system for the elephants. But because the mastodons were living at high latitudes, they were able to be a bigger body mass and still be able to keep their bodies from overheating. In fact, some of them had to actually have a wool over them, the woolly mammoths, to keep them warm in the high Arctic. Now, here's another slide showing a herd of these mastodons or mammoths. And what you notice is how long their tusks are and how curved their tusks are. In fact, this is a fully reconstructed giant mammoth that's on display in the Natural Museum in Victoria, British Columbia. In fact, Kathy and I have actually been and seen that very display. Very well constructed. But here's a question for you. What were these tusks being used for? Why that shape and why that great length? Or for that matter, what about the tusks of the African elephants? What are they being used for? I mean, is it just decoration? They're piano keys. All right.
Billiard balls.
Well, people have suggested that maybe that's why God gave these big, huge tusks to these creatures, so we could, harvest the ivory and make pianos and other things. But no, there's a real purpose and benefit for these creatures having these gigantic tusks, because after all, these things are heavy. And so the creature pays quite a price to carry this stuff around. So, any of you ever been to Africa and watched these elephants and how they use their tusks?
Usually, but they don't bark off tree because the under bark is the most nutritious part of the tree. They do a lot of damage.
Right. And you're right on target, is that these tusks are used to harvest food and forests. And so, my wife and I have been to Africa and have watched these elephants use their tusks to literally tear down trees. They'll actually grab them, shake the tree, uproot the tree, and they eat the leaves off the tree, strip the bark off the tree, and eat what's underneath the bark. And the mastodons were especially equipped to do this. They were more powerful, they had stronger tusks, and with that curvature, they were able to wrap it around a trunk and literally take the tree down. By the way, this shows you the territory of the mammoths and mastodons. 10,000, 20,000 years ago. By the way, this also shows you the land bridge. So where you see that white part, that's not ice and snow. That was actually a time when the sea levels were a lot lower. You just go back 20,000 years, the sea levels were like 300 feet lower than what they are today. And so there was a land bridge joining Asia to North America. And so the habitat of the mammoths and mastodons literally went all the way from France and Spain all the way to the east coast of North America. And so what exists in this region? So where you see that green over there, basically what does the habitat look like? What does it look like today?
Forest.
It's forest. And, when the mastodons first arrived in North America and Asia, those were heavily forested areas. Now, mastodons and mammoths were not long here on the face of the earth. They were relatively newly introduced species. We don't know exactly the date when they arrived, but sometime during the Ice Age, they showed up and covered this area. And they were in the process of transforming these heavily forested areas into prairies, basically because they're so efficient at eating and, you know, uprooting and eating the trees, that they were in danger of wiping out the forest. And so that kind of gives you a tip-off as to why we actually have benefited from the extinction of mastodons and mammoths, is if they had remained into our era, there would be no forests in Siberia, no forests in Canada. It would have all been uprooted and transformed into grasslands. And if that had happened, as dry as those areas are today, they would have been much drier, and it would have actually affected the grass. Because right now, those regions you see there, look at Siberia and Canada, where you have those heavy forests, it's about 10 inches of rain a year, precipitation equivalent, which is enough to maintain the forest where it's that cold. However, if you knock the forests out, that means less water gets transpired to the atmosphere, which means the precipitation will not be as big as 10 inches of rain equivalent. It's going to be less than that, which means that the grass that replaces the forest is not going to be able to sustain a large ecosystem or animal population. Yes?
So just to kind of get an idea of the timeline, I forget, when do we first see mastodon appearing? Is that during the Cambrian period or during the...
Oh, no, they're very recent. We're talking tens of thousands of years. Yeah. Exactly when they show up is hard to tell. And basically our knowledge of these creatures comes right here in Los Angeles. And also we get an idea of what kept the mastodons and the mammoths from totally destroying the forest during the last ice age. It was this creature. Everybody know what that is? It's a saber-toothed tiger, right. It was the only predator that was capable of taking down a mammoth or a mastodon, and could only take down the young ones, the really old ones, or the sick ones. But it was sufficient to keep the population of mastodons and mammoths sufficiently in check that they didn't wipe out all the forests. The problem is, these creatures went extinct. And there's a big debate. Did the mastodons go extinct and the saber-toothed tigers died? Or did something happen in terms of the climate or humans coming into the area that wiped out the saber-toothed tigers and the mastodons? But they basically disappeared about the same time. And so we don't have saber-toothed tigers anymore. We don't have mammoths or mastodons anymore. But you can imagine what would have happened if these creatures went extinct and the mastodons didn't. And by the way, what we do observe is that we have evidence for mastodons that, I'm trying to think when the last mastodon was, I think like 2,800 years ago or 2,300 years ago, so relatively recent, we have evidence for a mastodon, but the latest evidence for saber-toothed tigers does not come up that far. We're talking like 7,000 years ago for the last one, but of course, you know, we don't have complete data. And most of the data we have comes from downtown Los Angeles. What exists in downtown Los Angeles? La Brea tar pits. You've all heard of that. Well, the vast majority of specimens we have of saber-toothed tigers comes from the La Brea tar pits. And by the way, our best specimens of mastodons comes from the La Brea tar pits. And by the way, they're still pulling them out. I think they've brought out like 300 saber-toothed tigers already. And given that their primary diet were these mastodons and mammoths, probably what was going on is these big, heavy, lumbering creatures, the mastodons and the mammoths, took a wrong step into the tar and began to sink. And the saber-toothed tiger said, boy, there's an easy lunch. Here's this giant creature that's stuck in the tar, and, it's not going to be able to do anything. I'll be able to get an easy kill. But as they, quote, killed the creature, and maybe that explains why we don't have as many mastodons out of La Brea as we do tigers. The tigers probably ate them before they got stuck in the tar, and then the tiger got preserved, but not much of the mastodon. Anyway, here's some... other shots of what the saber-toothed tigers look like. Yes?
In the map on the range of the mastodons and mammoths, it didn't include Los Angeles.
Didn't include Los Angeles, but we do find them there. Yeah. So
Those are primary ranges. Obviously, they went beyond that.
They went beyond that, right. In fact, all the forests of Canada, we do see evidence that they were there. So, and what you notice there is that, you know, it only covers part of that region. But that's where we find most of the finds, yes.
So do we have any other areas that are like Liberia tar pits where we're constantly pulling out more specimens from those areas?
Nothing of the quality of the Liberia tar pits. So the Liberia tar pits is really the primary source for these fossils. And the one thing is, I mean, they fall into the tar, basically the entire body of the creature is perfectly preserved. Because the tar cuts off the oxygen, cuts off the water, cuts off the bacteria. So yeah, you're not going to get better preservation. And the Liberia tar pits are big. So actually the majority of all the saber-toothed tigers that have ever been recovered in the entire world have come from the Liberia tar pits.
So the
other thing we find a lot in the tar pits, obviously, is wolves. I think there's actually more wolves than saber-toothed tigers.
Right.
And then one woman also was trapped and recovered her remains, which were really valuable also for, again, finding other specimens.
Right. So, and they've actually tried to say if we could find some more people in the La Brea tar pits, we could actually do some DNA analysis. But so far, they've only found one human, a woman that died about 9,000 years ago. Why she got stuck on the tar, that's another mystery. So.
She was hungry.
Yeah.
She had a bad abscess, and they think it might have been suicide. They're not positive.
Oh, it might have been suicide.
Yeah,
okay.
Her whole jaw was kind of rotted.
Well, I mean, when you got that kind of pain, she might have been so crazed with pain that she tripped and fell.
Or they threw her in. Who knows?
They might have thrown her in, right?
Now, did the large fauna cross? Did they originate in Europe or Asia and then cross? They weren't from North America originally?
That's a debate. Whether or not we don't have a, it's hard. You don't have a complete database. There obviously were more of them than we've recovered. But yeah, you do see them. And by the way, I think the last live mastodon they found was in this island up here in Russia. I forget the name of the island, but that big island is where they found the last one. They found one in Canada that goes back like 3,000 years.
There's a pygmy mammoth on San Nicolas Island. You know,
right.
And you think it could be as recent as 2000 years.
The pygmies lasted longer than the big guys did. But in terms of the big guys, they actually found some on one of those north islands. Over here.
The amount of forest that was turned into prairies by the humans, was that fine-tuned where we have just the amount of prairies that we need for some reason?
I don't know. I mean, again, there's a lot of unknowns on this. All I'm sharing with you is that the mastodons and mammoths were as abundant as they were, say, 30,000 years ago. We'd be in trouble today because they would have basically stripped Canada and Siberia of all of its forests, turned into grassland, and wouldn't be as productive as the grasslands we have today. You know, the prairies, for example, in Canada get between 20 and 30 inches of rain. You wouldn't get that if there weren't the adjoining forests. So they would have, basically, you'd have less vegetation to support the animals and in future human beings and their agriculture. Yeah, Jim.
How do they pull them out of the tar pits? Does the bones, do they float up to the surface? How do they get to them?
Well, I mean, you're the expert, right?
Yeah, you have to dig down. Most of the tar is almost hardened. Oh. You know, it's not all of it's real soft. There's some areas that are soft. The older parts are hardened, and the bones are just all mixed up and stirred up. So you don't find an entire animal.
Oh, okay.
You find pieces, and a lot of the specimens they put together are from several animals.
How deep is that coil? How far does it go?
I'm not positive, but we've dug down as far as 50 feet.
Oh, okay.
And it keeps going. It gets more dangerous, though, because it seeps in.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Okay, yeah, Mara.
These are in the fish animal, right?
Yes.
So they were around all during Adam and Eve and man and all that stuff, right?
Well, I don't know whether there were saber-toothed tigers in the Garden of Eden.
Right.
but because they seem to need a colder climate. So.
But they were made on the sixth day.
Yeah, yeah, they'd be part of the six-day creatures. So again, here we go with the saber-toothed tigers. And you get a bunch of them. They're able to take down a mastodon. And by the way, this is from the La Brea tar pits. And shows you that's their maximum jaw opening, which is quite impressive. Like about 145 degree jaw opening, which explains... Pardon me?
Saw something kind of like that at Thanksgiving.
The other important part of that forest, obviously, that makes probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of our oxygen. You know, from Canada to Siberia, there's a higher oxygen content in Siberia and Canada than there is here in California because those trees make, in the summertime, make so much oxygen. Obviously, the oceans make most of the oxygen, but those forests are important for, A, regulating the temperature of the planet, but also for producing oxygen.
Right. And, you know, that forest area supports an enormous ecosystem. You got moose, you got caribou, you got beaver there. And because of the forest, it's actually warmer at the surface of the ground than it would be if the forest weren't there, so it'd be much colder. And again, you wouldn't have as much grass. So, yeah, it'd be bad news all the way around if the mastodons had wiped up those forests. And they were just about to do that before they went extinct. And the saber-toothed tigers went extinct with them. But exactly what caused the extinction of the mastodons and the extinction of the saber-toothed tigers is still not known. One theory is that when humans invaded, they quickly killed off the mastodons. Another theory is that there was very rapid climate change going on at the close of the last ice age. And that's the same time that the mastodons went extinct. Or it might have been a combination of the two. Or, you know, who knows? So it's still being debated. But what is certain is that, hey, it's a good thing that they are gone, because what would have happened if they had remained? So, and incidentally, in Africa, if there are areas where the elephants have done considerable damage to the jungle terrain, basically because they uproot the trees and transform the land from a forest into a savanna. But the thing about Africa is the elephants do have predators, and the predators do keep them under control. And nowadays, we're worried about actually allowing the elephants to survive, period, because of the fact that their tusks are being exploited. So, anyway, thank God for those creatures going extinct. So, okay, we're in Ecclesiastes, and chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes. And where we ended up last week... And by the way, what we're doing is going through all the creation chapters in the Bible, and Ecclesiastes has a lot of content on creation. And we began with the creation chapter 3 last time, where it says there's a time. And it's one of these very repetitious passages, and we talked about last week, whenever you see repetition in the Bible, pay attention. The repetition is making a point. But how many times do you see the word time? From verses 1 all the way through to verse 8. You're basically seeing in each verse two times. So basically 16, it mentions the word time. A time to do this, a time to do that. A time to do X, a time to do Y. As we talked last time, the point of this text is, as you look at those things, there's a right time for each of these things to be expressed. And, you know, how it says right thereafter, as it goes through all these times, everything is beautiful in its own time. And so whatever we see taking place in the face of the earth, there is a moment, if it happens at the right time, where it is a really beautiful thing. And so everything, even the ugly things that we see, actually have within them an aspect of beauty and good. And, you know, God created everything. Everything brings him pleasure. And everything is good in its own time. And also we discussed how there aren't really any coincidences. God is in control of all these times. He's in control of all the things that happen in your life. So you think of all the disasters that take place, as it says in Romans 8, everything works out for the good, even the bad stuff, for those that are called to God and are committed to His purpose. And so just recognizing that God is in control. Yes?
I feel like this is possibly a loaded question, but I can't help but wonder, based off of that, how does that sort of figure into things like free will? Because there's always that question where, like, God is in control and He knows what He's doing, but how much of it is actually left up to us?
Okay, good question. You should have been with us 35 years ago, where we spent a year on the question of human free will and divine predestination. But
I think about that time I was like a glimmer in my parents' eyes. Maybe.
Maybe. So maybe we can recover all that material. But in one sense, I wrote a book based on that year that we taught this here in the Paradoxes class. And the book is called Beyond the Cosmos. It's now in a third edition, and it's over there at the table. So, and there's also a DVD by the same title that you can get. But the book is where you go into detail on how you resolve those two doctrines. But one reason why I wrote the book is because there's an evangelistic tool there. If you look at all the religions of the world and all the holy books outside of the Bible and Christianity, they pick one or the other. So, for example, in Islam, they pick predestination. Allah is the one who controls everything. However, what you see in Islam is that they deny human free will. And so that explains why they don't take responsibility for their actions. You know, Allah wills it. So, I mean, you know, I killed all these people, but it was the will of Allah. And so, but then you get other religions that basically ignore predestination, and all they do is hit the human free will. And so you get one or the other. What's interesting about the Bible, it teaches both. And it confronts us with an apparent contradiction. How can God control? Because the Bible actually says predetermination in very strong language, where He predetermines everything before He created the universe. So before the universe even existed, everything was predetermined. And when we taught the class, I took them through passages of the Bible where it says, you know, does God partially control, or is it more than that? What we discovered over the past a few months is about 1,500 passages in the Bible that teach the doctrine of predestination. But basically, we're drawn to the conclusion, before God created the universe, He had predetermined, predestined every thought I would think, every word I would speak, every action I would perform. Now, if that's the case, where is there free will? Okay? Well, we spent another 3 months in the class looking at all the passages that teach free will, which basically makes the point, and this text does here, we're getting to it right next, makes the point that God holds us responsible for all of our thoughts, all of our words, and all of our actions. And we're going to be judged based on everything we thought. You know, often we think we're only going to be judged on our actions. No, you're going to be judged in every word you speak and every thought you think. Now, that shouldn't terrify you before a holy God. I don't know what will. The fact that even my thoughts are going to be judged by God, and you'll say, we're in trouble, yeah. Except for the grace of God, we'd be in really deep trouble. But we have all these scriptures basically making a point that we're totally responsible for every thought we think, every word we speak, and every action we perform. And what's really chilling, and we spent just a few days in the class looking at this, there are actually verses in the Bible that teach both doctrines in the same verse. So a good example is Joel 2:32. All who call upon the name of the Lord will be saved, all those whom the Lord calls. So basically saying, the only way you can be saved is if you take the action and call upon God to save you. But in the same sentence it says, you're only going to be saved if God calls you. They're both in the same sentence. And the Bible does that repeatedly. So it's basically making a point. You may not understand how this works out, But I'm telling you as God, it's both. It's both human free will and divine predestination. Now, I've actually argued in my book Beyond the Cosmos, that's one proof we have that the Bible is the inspired Word of God. Because there's a principle here. We can only visualize phenomena and dimensions we personally experience. And I spend some time in the book explaining how in the context of length, width, height, and time, it's impossible to reconcile the doctrine of divine predestination simultaneously operating with human free will. Utterly impossible. It can't be done in four dimensions. Which explains why no other holy book except the Bible teaches both. Okay? Because if it's written by a man, it's going to show the limitations of human visualization. But if it's from God, we should expect that at least in a few places in the inspired writing, it's going to transcend the limits of human visualization. And by the way, the Bible does this more than once. Notice in Christianity, we have taught the doctrine of the Trinity. You don't see that in Islam. You don't see that in Hinduism or Buddhism. It's either many gods or one God, but it's not three gods and one essence. By the way, every Christian cult denies the Trinity. So you don't see it in Jehovah's Witnesses. You don't see it in Mormonism. You don't see it in Christian Science. By the way, Judaism denies the Trinity. Their Bible doesn't, but their religion denies the doctrine of the Trinity. Mainly because it's beyond the limits of human visualization. But the fact that we see it taught both in the Old Testament and the New Testament is evidence that this book is indeed the inspired Word of God. So, what we did, by the way, in Beyond the Cosmos, and we did this for, I think we took about 6 months in the class to do this, is show you multiple ways you can have divine predestination simultaneously operating with human free will on one condition. We don't put God in a four-dimensional box. We allow God to be bigger than those four space-time dimensions. And by the way, there's merit for that. The Bible tells us that God created the space-time dimensions. It tells us there'll come a time when he's going to remove them. And by the way, physics now proves that the beginning of the universe was the beginning of space and time. So we now have proof from physics that there must be an agent beyond space and time that created space and time. Therefore, how can he be limited by our space-time dimensions? And so just simply taking the exercise, what if God were able to operate in multiple dimensions of space and time? Well, I show you three different ways that God could give you total control over your will and yet predetermine every thought, word, and action you speak throughout your entire life before he created the universe. Now, by the way, all three of the solutions I offer in the book could be dead wrong. That's not my concern. God's got thousands, if not an infinite number of ways of resolving the paradox. I'm just saying if I, as a mere man, can come up with three, God can come up with others. And what I'm basically doing is showing you it's not a contradiction. It's simply a paradox. And the difference between a paradox and a contradiction, a paradox is a contradiction that is resolved by getting a different perspective. And so one thing we did in the class is show you lots of paradoxes that you're all familiar with. Well, maybe not so familiar. Things like light being both a wave and a particle. Or how quantum mechanics operates. But the whole point is we're forced to accept numerous paradoxes just through our study of science. And therefore, we should expect that we're going to find the same thing in Scripture. Okay, that's a little sidetrack that we did there. But it actually is relevant to the text we're talking about. Because it's making the point here in these first eight verses, there is a time that's ideal and optimal. And even the things that we think are ugly are beautiful in their own time. And God has control over time. He's got control over events in our life. But there are things that make us question and wonder. And so I'm going to jump from verse 8 down to verse 15. Whatever is has already been. And what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account. So basically, Solomon here is making the point there's really nothing new going on. The laws of physics have been operating since God created the universe, and therefore we can't really say, you know, this is new. Whatever has already been, what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account. Now, that explains why we respond to death different than the animals, because we are going to be judged. It tells us that in John 16, that every human being knows that judgment's coming. That includes the atheists. They may react by saying, well, we don't think it's true, we hope it's not true, but the truth is, that's what makes us concerned about death. And then verse 18 or 16, and I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. And I thought in my heart, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed. But if you look at what it says there in verse 16, it's basically saying where we would expect to see righteousness, virtue, and wise judgment, we see the opposite. Wickedness, it comes where we expect righteousness. And we wonder why. Well, I'm going to throw that question out to you. What's going on? And isn't the 20th century one of the best examples, 20th and 21st century, one of the best examples of where we'd anticipate righteous, virtuous actions, we get exactly the opposite. It doesn't make sense. It's not rational. And that's basically what Solomon is saying here. But the question I'm asking all of you is why? Because that's an important point that's underlying here. Yes?
It makes us have to trust him. We can't figure it out.
You can't figure it out. Okay, let me pose some examples to you. In the 20th century, we had Joe Stalin killing 20 million of the professional people in Russia. This was kind of the cream of the crop. His best generals, his best scientists, his best lawyers and economists, medical doctors, 20 million of them were killed. Why would he do that? What does it make sense? I mean, people said he almost lost World War II because of the people he killed. I mean, he had incompetent generals replace the competent generals. And, you know, what happened to him? I mean, if it wasn't for America rescuing Stalin, they would have lost the Second World War. So, and then you got, in Germany, the same thing happening. You got Adolf Hitler basically killing off his best people. You know, does that make sense? I mean, here's Adolf Hitler wanting to set up a 1,000-year-long Reich. Now, if that was really your goal, why would you kill off your top people? Or likewise, Stalin, trying to establish communism to exist throughout the entire world. Why kill off the best resources that are going to be necessary to make that happen? Yes.
Well, I was curious because they were paranoid. They were protecting their own power.
They were paranoid. They were protecting their own power. But if they're protecting their own power, that doesn't make sense.
They were lunatics.
They were lunatics, right. But here's the point I'm making. Because this is what Solomon is raising. He says, you know, we have these judges. We have these rulers. We expect them to be rational, the decisions that they make. I mean, just look at Washington. How much rationality do we see flowing out of Washington? So, I mean, I can think back to William Proxmire when there was all this money being spent by astronomers searching for extraterrestrial intelligent life. And he said, you know, when I talk to astronomers about the odds of us finding that intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, I'm not going to vote for funding until we first find intelligent life in Washington. So, and he was able to kill the funding bill for the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. But the point is, I mean, we look at the political leaders of the world, or, you know, go to Britain. Does it make sense, the decisions that Neville Chamberlain made in the 1930s? I mean, Churchill writes about this. He says, in 1933... we could have stopped World War II happening without firing a single shot. All we had to do is tell the Germans at the Rhine, no, you can't come and take over the Rhineland. So they took over the Rhineland without a shot, without an army, without a navy or anything. we let them take it over. But that was step one of many steps that led to World War II. Or what happened in 1938 when you had this coalition of Russia, France, and England, and Czechoslovakia basically set in place to say no to Hitler. That would have stopped the war. Because the generals told Hitler, we're not ready to take him on. And by the way, at that time, Czechoslovakia had an army of 1.5 million men. They were standing on the border ready to put up a fight, and the Russians were going to come in, the French and the British were coming in. And, you know, the generals knew that if that were to happen, we got to stop. But look at the decision that Neville Chamberlain made. It just doesn't make sense. Made no sense whatsoever. By the way, whatever happened right after that, remember Neville Chamberlain came back and said, there will be no war?
Yeah.
And what did Churchill say? War is guaranteed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just made sure we're going to have a war. All you did was delay it and made it worse. So I'm basically saying, we see it on both sides of the political spectrum. People making irrational decisions that are counter to their best interests. How do you explain that? And that's basically what Solomon is saying here, is that we see judges making decisions that make no sense whatsoever. By the way, can you think of some judgments made here in North America by our courts that don't make any sense? Well, we can name numerous examples. Okay, here's my challenge. What's going on here to explain this phenomena? Okay, in the back.
This is God.
This is God. In what way? All right, I'm going to press you a little bit further. Okay, exactly what's going on behind the screen? What's the mistake we humans are making when we see our leaders making completely absurd, irrational decisions?
I think that's God making his plan work.
God making his plan work, and how is that unfolding? Okay, in the back? We fight not against flesh and blood. Okay, very good. You know, we think this is a human thing, a conflict between human beings, but there's something going on behind the scene. There is supernatural forces that are evil. Now, yeah, God's in total control. God controls everything that Satan does, but this is the work of Satan and his demons. And we're told in places like the book of Daniel that the fallen angels are in cahoots with the politicians. So when we see our political leaders making really crazy decisions, it's not coming from their mind. It's satanic, demonic forces that are at work. Now, the book of Daniel also tells us that there are angels allied with God that are at work. But there's a battle going on, a spiritual battle that we only see just vestiges of. But we need to recognize it's more than just a human conflict. And so when we see judges making terrible decisions, realize they're being influenced by supernatural forces that are evil. You were going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, our own natural fallen nature. Like in Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful above all things, beyond cure, who can know it? So we have our part in there too.
Well, that's a good point. Because of our sin nature, we're inherently irrational in the decisions that we make. You know, Jeremiah 17, the fact that the human heart is wicked beyond what we can even imagine. And so when we see our children doing things that make no sense, we see ourselves doing things that make no sense, yeah, we can blame the fallen nature. But on top of that, there is a supernatural element. And you're especially going to see the supernatural element at work amongst leaders. And by the way, I think that explains why you see so many leaders of churches and ministries doing things that just seem utterly irrational. Spiritual forces are at work, and they particularly target the leaders.
So the answer, don't go into leadership? I mean, are there leaders that can handle it?
Well, by the way, the Apostle Paul says that. You know, those of you who aspire towards a spiritual leadership position, be wary. Because there will be challenges. And the challenges are not just going to be the forces that we can see. And so, yeah, we need to think twice before accepting a role of a leadership in any kind of ministry. And by the way, we need more leaders. We shouldn't look at that passage and say, well, we're not even going to think about it. The point is, there's a shortage of leaders within the body of Christ, and the people need not be dissuaded, but they need to be ready. And, you know, Paul also explains how we can take on those, you know, how we can protect ourselves. So, and by the way, where I see it in Christian leadership is basically with individuals that are not in an accountable position. And so one thing we need to do in terms of our Christian leaders is protect them from isolation. Where there's isolation, there's great risk. And so I would say that to anybody who's in the ministry, be careful not to isolate yourself. And be careful to be transparent before others. So, because the devil is after you. Or something like this. So, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. And where we expect virtue, where we expect a righteous judgment, we get exactly the opposite. And the 20th and 21st century has been ripe with that. And our justice system has been ripe with that. But then it says, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed. Now, I want to switch us to the very end of Ecclesiastes, because it basically picks up this verse 17. And by the way, we had a debate last week. Who really wrote the book of Ecclesiastes? Well, when we look at the conclusion of Ecclesiastes, picking it up in verse 9. Chapter 12, last chapter of Ecclesiastes, looking at the last couple of paragraphs. Not only was the teacher wise, but also he imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. Now, there's little debate within the Christian community that King Solomon was responsible for virtually all of the proverbs that we see in the book of Proverbs. And this paragraph that I just read there, I mean, it sure seems to fit the one who is writing all these proverbs. Now, where there's been some debate, it talks about the teacher in the third person. So some people have thought, well, maybe Ecclesiastes was not written by King Solomon. It might have been written by a compatriot, which basically recorded what he had heard from Solomon and wrote this down. But keep in mind, most of Ecclesiastes is first person. Now, this passage, it switches to the third person. And there are times when it's useful for someone writing a treatise to conclude with a third person if you're really trying to make a strong point. So I don't think that that's going to go very far. So that's one reason why I think this really was written by King Solomon. Yes?
So a question based off of a couple of surrounding verses in Ecclesiastes and based off of the whole there's a time for everything. A lot of times when I've talked to non-Christians about why they don't really tackle these really difficult questions of like where they think they're going to go when they die, they always cite like, well, when you think about it, everything is meaningless. Like everything that I do is such a tiny freckle on the timeline of the universe. And I think in a couple of verses here, the teacher is cited saying everything is meaningless. But so how does that sort of work with an evangelical message of saying, yes, what you do does matter, that you matter to God immensely, and yet you came from dust and to dust you shall return? Is that another paradox?
Yes, and that's why it's so important to look at these last few sentences of Ecclesiastes 12. Because basically what you got here is King Solomon telling his life story of how he tried to find meaning in accumulating wealth. He tried to find meaning in great building projects. And basically says, no other king has built what I have built of such high quality and such grandeur. And he says, you know, I tried money. I tried building projects. I tried wisdom. I poured my time and energy in developing these amazing proverbs and into instructing people. I tried women. Says, I tried it more than anybody else has tried. You know, I was the wisest of all men. I was the wealthiest of all men. Did more building projects. and all of it was meaningless. And he basically concludes, it says, there's only one thing that has meaning, and it's your relationship with God. And it's in preparing for the judgment that you will face, and how everyone will face. So not only was the teacher wise, but also he imparted knowledge to the people. He thought he could find fulfillment in imparting knowledge to the people. He says, even that is meaningless. He pondered and stretched out and set in order many properties. You know what's interesting here? After 11 and a half chapters, he says, based of all the things I've done, the thing that probably has the greatest value amongst all the meaningless things I've done is my composing and writing these proverbs and giving people wisdom. Now, you say, boy, that's got real value, much more value than money. But his point is, even that is meaningless. The words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. So he's basically making the point there is real value in these wise sayings, wise writings, and wise proverbs. Then he goes on to say, of making many books, there is no end. Boy, look at all the books that are being published today. I mean, anybody can get a book published today. Of making many books, there's no end, and much study wearies the body. Not sure I really understood that one. I haven't really experienced that myself. But now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter, and here's the answer to your question. Now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So he's basically saying the only thing that has any meaning is your relationship with God and getting ready for the judgment you'll face with God and what He's got promised for life thereafter. Everything else is meaningless in comparison to that. In the back.
When I read this, I don't know if it was when I first read this, I don't know if it was the King James, they say vanity, vanity, all is vanity.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like that. Because it's like man's pride. It's, you know what I'm saying? Rather than, and it is meaningless. But I kind of like the interpretation of vanity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting how Solomon concludes that. Because he's basically saying even his ministry of instructing God's wisdom to people is vanity. Mm-hmm. So even my ministry has no ultimate meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of Christians that get caught up in that. They get, you know, their whole purpose for life becomes the ministry that they're undertaking. But, you know, what we see here from King Solomon is, you know, that has greater value and worth than all the other meaningless things I've done, but even that is meaningless.
And it's like the pride, you know, the whole thing with the fall of Adam and the devil. I mean, it's Satan.
Well, for example, if there is no God and there is no judgment, what value is there in wise instruction of virtual moral training? Does that have any purpose?
Really?
No. I mean, if there is no God, why bother with morality? I mean, that's what I find what's interesting in engaging atheists. They're all about, in the context of their atheism, saying that morality has value and purpose. And that we atheists are more moral than non-atheists. We've even heard atheists in the class here say that. That if you're an atheist, you're actually more moral than being a Christian. But the whole point is, if there is no God, why bother with morality at all? I mean, you're really no better off than a rock or a piece of dust or a star. And, you know, if there is no God, if there is no judgment, what value is it? It has no purpose. But if there is a God, if there's a judgment coming, then all of that has purpose and meaning. Yes, Tim?
I have to say this kind of brings up to the point of that there is purpose for these things in a ministry sense, that we have this partnership with God in bringing people to Christ, which is the Great Commission we're supposed to be doing. What we're supposed to be doing is bringing these people by our own actions and words and whatnot to God's doorstep, to where He can do the work of bringing them in, and only He can do that. So to say this is meaningless is not quite true, because this is all part of bringing us to that point where God can do His part.
Tim, that's exactly where I wanted to go. So thank you for leading us down that path. If there is a God and if judgment is coming, then all the stuff that Solomon talked about that he did throughout all of his life now takes on meaning. So if there is no God, building great buildings has no meaning. But if there is a God, these buildings now do take on meaning and purpose if they're done to bring glory to God. And likewise, the accumulation of wealth. I can use that wealth to further God's purpose. So, now the women part, I mean, we'll skip that part, but... yes?
Is he saying that he found no meaning because he didn't find, he wasn't, like, really enjoying it because there was a selfish reason of all, like, the purpose behind, like, oh, I'm going to look good in history, kind of like away from what really God wants from a person of his?
Well, that's kind of his story. I tried to find meaning, purpose, and value in building up this powerful nation with great wealth. But what does it all mean if there is no God? It's all going to be forgotten. You know, how many people actually know a lot about Solomon's building projects today? It's forgotten. Or take another example. How many of you can name the three greatest sports heroes of 200 years ago? You can probably name them of today. But 200 years ago? Or, you know, when you consider the fame that actors and actresses have today, how many of you can name any of the actors or actresses that existed that participated in Shakespeare's plays when Shakespeare wrote his plays? We know Shakespeare. We don't know his actors and actresses. The truth is, though, in Shakespeare's day, his actors and actresses were more famous than he was. But, you know, who remembers them today? And who's going to remember the actors of today 100 years from now? So... But the whole point is, if there is a God, then suddenly these things do take on meaning and purpose if they're done from the perspective of furthering God's purpose in your life. Okay, Dave.
Yeah, I think Isaiah and Jesus really drove home, obviously, the motive is more important than anything. That two people could do exactly the same thing, and on Judgment Day, one would be rewarded for it, the other person would be punished for it.
Exactly.
Based on their motive, you know. I mean, coming out of a works-oriented cult, you know, that contrast was just so great, you know, that finally reading the book of Romans and understanding grace and understanding that the motive is just so much more important, or being a works-oriented cult, obviously, you know, there was never assurance of salvation, you know, but what I was doing was futile and you could never measure up to what you want to. Once I found grace, I could do the same thing and more and have joy, whereas before it was a burden.
Very good. Yeah.
The atheists would argue that the need for morality is among other things, for instance, to promote community. You can't have a decent life if you have to worry about people stealing from you and killing you and all that. So the need for self-protection.
Well, that's the atheist argument for morality. They said we can explain morality through evolution. Right. It gave human beings a survival advantage. But isn't evolution the survival of the fittest? And so what you see is people who are deeply committed to atheistic and Darwinian evolution basically abuse. You know, what you see Hitler saying to the Christians, you be moral so I don't have to be. So basically it's the wicked taking advantage of the righteous. So
the community still, they may not be the strongest, you know, one individual may be the strongest, but everybody else in the community can recognize, you know what, this guy's ruining our life. We need to deal with
that. Right. Well, I mean, there is certain survival advantages to morality. I mean, we need to acknowledge that. But how do you explain the origin of morality? Because we didn't start off with big cities and nations and technology and transportation systems. We started off as individuals. So where does it come from? So that's the challenge the atheist is facing. In the context of your belief system, how can you explain the origin of morality?
The ones who were moral survived.
Ones that were moral survived, right?
You know, I've been in this argument with atheists.
Right.
And I don't know how to resolve it with them. Because
we're also the only species that both does good, not to our benefit, and bad, not to our benefit. I mean, we don't fit in with any other species on this planet.
But the communities that depend solely upon might makes right didn't survive. But the ones who abuse their fellow humans, they would not survive.
Well, I think that's where our text takes some point here in chapter 3. is there supernatural forces working behind the scenes. And yes, we can explain the idiocy and the counterproductive decisions that humans make, because it's not just the human mind that's at work, there's demonic forces at work. However, there's twice as many good angels as there are evil angels, and they're battling these evil angels. And so we see this back and forth. And again, that's the challenge of atheism. How can you explain the extreme evil that human beings express in the context of a Darwinian model or an atheistic model? And at the same time, how do you explain the extreme examples of altruism? And so you contrast human beings with, say, the animals. The animals actually tend to behave in a fairly rational fashion, in the sense that, you know, these saber-toothed tigers, they see a big, healthy mastodon, and they say, we're going to leave that character alone, because it's not going to be to our advantage to try to make lunch out of that particular mastodon. They look for some young, weak, sick one. They said, oh, he got separated from the tribe. There's no other big mastodons around. I think we can have an easy lunch here. And you see that with the animals. They always take the path of greatest ease. But we see human beings doing the opposite. They don't take the path of greatest ease. They don't take the path that's to their advantage. They do things, you know, again, how do you explain the actions of Mao Zedong, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin? How do you explain the incredible altruistic acts? I mean, you see that in the New Testament, where it talks about how there are human beings who will sacrifice their life for someone they don't even know. And we see examples of that. How do you explain that in the context of atheistic? And so we see extreme evil being expressed by humans. That makes no sense. We also see extreme altruism being expressed by humans. That makes no rational sense. So I think that's the way to respond to the atheist. The atheist loves to talk about actions of humanity and morality in very broad general terms. They don't look at the extremes. And extremes don't make sense from their worldview perspective. So there was a question over here that I was missing. No? Okay. All right. Now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whatever is good and evil. Last sentence here. But we have other passages that tell us that God doesn't judge everything. How do you square this passage with passages like you see in the New Testament epistles, and particularly in the book of Ezekiel, where God basically says, I'll judge you for this, but I will not judge you for that? How do you square that with this text where it says, everything for every individual, good and evil, will be judged? Yes?
Could it possibly also be a translation thing? Like, because usually when we think of judgment, we think instantly of the connection between judgment and condemnation. Like, when you judge someone, like, that whole language connotation is like, you instantly are guilty of something because you're being judged. But...
Well, I'm going to suggest that this is not a translation issue, because this isn't the only place that makes these kinds of statements. So again, we're back into these paradoxical issues that we see in the Bible, where you've got passages which basically make the point, for every human being, everything will be judged, good and bad. And other passages that say, no, God's going to select. Because the promise for people who give their life to Jesus Christ is, every evil thing that you've ever thought or said or done is erased and forgotten and will not be called upon for judgment. Whereas what does it say for the person who refuses to submit to the authority of Jesus Christ? Every good thing you have done or thought or said will be forgotten and erased and will not be judged. And so what you see in the other religions of the world is on judgment day. By the way, every religion teaches there will be a judgment day. But where they depart from Christianity is they teach that God's going to weigh you in the balance, good deeds versus bad deeds. What Christianity says is before God does that, He's going to empty one of the tins. And so you get judged 100% on your good deeds or 100% on your bad deeds. It won't be good versus bad. How do you reconcile that with this text? John.
Well, there are
things that will be judged in the Messiah.
So the things that will be judged?
In the Messiah, in Christ.
Okay, you're on to it. In other words, every evil thing we have done and said and thought has already been judged. When we come to judgment day, that judgment's been taken care of. We're going to be judged for what's left. And so Christ took care of the judgment of all. So he's the one that suffered the consequences for all of our evil thoughts, words, and actions. That judgment's been taken care of. What remains? And so, as we see in 1 Corinthians 12, when we face judgment day, it's an award ceremony. And the evil things we've done will not be called to account. They've already been judged. So that's how you reconcile that with this text. Yes, everything has been judged, but we're not the only ones that take care of the judgment. If we've gone to Christ and say, you know, I want to trade my moral imperfection for your moral perfection. I want you to take care of the judgment of all the evil things that I've done. And if we do that, he will take care of it. So when we come to judgment day, it's simply based on the good things that we have done. God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. The evil's been taken care of. The good is yet to come. There will be an award ceremony that comes up. And for those who don't want Christ to rule over their life, it's going to be precisely the opposite. They'll be called to account for every evil deed they've done. You see that in Revelation chapter 20. Each one will receive a different judgment based on the evil that they have done. And the good that they have done will not be called to account. By the way, if you look in Ezekiel, it tells us it's really good for the rebels against God that their good deeds are not judged. You know, they're actually counting on good deeds versus bad deeds. But basically the message of Ezekiel is, it's to your advantage for God to empty that side of the scale that's got all your good deeds on it. And something you said, Dave, it's all about motive. If the motive for doing those good deeds was to glorify self or some human institution rather than God, what you think is a good deed is not a good deed. What do we see in Isaiah? All your good deeds are like filthy rags in God's nostrils because of the motive that's behind them. And so basically what God says in the book of Ezekiel, you say God is not fair for emptying one side of the scale. I'm telling you, God is fair. Because if God were to do it the way you want it to be done, all those good things that you've done would have to be transferred to the other side. And now your judgment is going to be far more severe than if I just simply empty the side of the scale with the good deeds on it. I'm doing you a favor by emptying the scale with the good things on it. Yes?
One of the sad things about Dennis Prager is he talks about motives. He doesn't believe in motives. He only believes in actions. So he can't understand Christianity thinking of motives. He says it all the time, which is sad.
It is sad. And the mistake is this, and it's not only done in Judaism, it's done in every religion outside of Christianity, thinking we're going to be judged for our actions. Some go so far as to say, we may also be judged for our words, but you don't see them saying, you're going to be judged for your thoughts. You know, and that's the power of what you see in the opening chapters of Matthew. You know, my colleague, Fuzz Rana, was challenged to read the Bible when he was an atheist, rebelling against an Islamic background. And he was challenged to start with Matthew chapter 1. He says, I got to chapter 7 and I was thoroughly converted. Mainly because what he saw was, oh my gosh, I'm going to be judged even for my thoughts. If I think something in anger against another human being, it's the same as if I killed that person. So the fact that we're going to be judged for our thoughts, and yeah, that's where I say, you know, Dennis Prager is going to need to make an adjustment. It's not just for your actions. It's not just your words. Well, we've had Jews here in the class who basically thought the Messiah hadn't come. And the common mistake is they're looking for a Messiah that will fulfill all the Old Testament prophecies.
And
interesting part. The interesting part is when you talk to them and I ask about Isaiah, they say, no, my rabbi told me not to read the book of Isaiah. Because Isaiah just screams Jesus.
It screams Jesus. It also screams that he's going to come twice.
Yeah. And that's why I pray, the Lamb of God and the Lion of Judah. You know, you got to understand he's both.
Well, the other thing that Jews are terribly ignorant on is the book of Daniel.
Yeah.
And you think they would be thrilled with Daniel because Daniel talks about what God's going to do to Jews and Israel in the future, how he's going to exalt them. But it's also the one book that says the Messiah comes twice. And to me, the incredible irony is that Orthodox Jews believe that Elijah comes twice. Hey, if a mere man can come twice, why can't the creator of the universe come twice? And then using the analogy of the donkey and the horse is that, you know, when the first time Jesus came, he came riding a donkey. The second time, he's going to come riding a horse. And every Jew knows the symbolism. A donkey is a symbol of peace. A horse is a symbol of conquest. They were looking for a conquering Messiah, but he came on a donkey. So, and by the way, I think they knew exactly what that meant when he entered Jerusalem. Here's this guy we thought would come and conquer and take off this yoke of the Romans. He's coming on a donkey. And so that's why the crowd turned against Jesus so quickly. They said, he's coming on a donkey. This isn't what we expected. Yes?
So when it comes to the whole being judged based off of our thoughts, another complaint that I've usually heard from non-Christians is how the institution of Christianity is constantly trying to control people's thoughts, and it's a method of, like, hurting people. And I've always wondered, when it comes to that kind of thing, for myself, I want to have the thoughts that please God and that kind of thing. But sometimes I worry that what they're saying is right, that my free will is somehow being stifled. But how do you sort of, not so much compromise, I'm trying to think of the word, how do you...
Okay, here's a reconciliation. The message of the Sermon on the Mount is God is going to judge every thought that you've ever thought throughout your entire life. You are in a hopeless situation if you're counting on good deeds versus bad deeds. You're not going to make it. And so, yeah, that's the whole message of the Sermon on the Mount is there is no hope if you're trying to do this through your own human effort. Unless God steps in, you are done. And that's what caused Buzz Rana to so quickly give his life to Christ, is realizing, wow, there is no other way out. This is the only option I have. But here's the flip side, where people complain that therefore Christianity is a thought-controlling religion. If you look at all the religions of the world, you see thought control in Islam. You see thought control in Hinduism. But one place you don't is in Christianity. What you see in Paul's words is he says, you know, don't try to protest in the temples. I mean, you know, people are going to do their own wicked things. Christianity is the only religion that tolerates freedom of religion. You don't see it in Mormonism. You don't see it in the Jehovah's Witnesses. You don't see it in Islam or in Hinduism. It's unique to Christianity. That people are free to choose whatever religion they want. And you see that even in the judgment passages of Ezekiel. You're free to choose to be a servant of the Lord High God or to reject Him. That is your choice. But your choice has consequences. So Christianity does teach that there are consequences to our choices. But it makes it clear you are a free will being. You get to choose. But there will be consequences. And, you know, we don't have laws that say if you're a Christian and convert to Islam, we're going to kill you or put you in prison. But hey, go to Saudi Arabia. If you're a Muslim and convert to Christianity, your days are numbered. Probably this many. So, I mean, there was a member of the class here. I was just sharing with Ross Hogan before class. Bill Considine was a member of this class for many years. And he was a systems analyst. And he was able to get lucrative jobs in Saudi Arabia. And he was able to give more to missions through the money that he earned. But he says, while I was there, I saw my role as a tent maker missionary. And by the way, there are very severe laws in Saudi Arabia against proselytizing. But he says, this is how it works. He says, I would be there with my wife and my daughters, and we'd be having a Bible study on Thursday night in our little apartment. Where doors close, blinds close. He says, we do that for me 1, 2, 3 weeks. And he says, he was there 4 times. He says, it would be less than 3 weeks before they'd get a knock on the door. They'd open the door, and there would be a man there, total stranger. And he says, what you notice in Saudi Arabia is a hospitality is extremely encouraged. If anybody comes to your door, it would be very rude not to offer food and drink. And so they offer food and drink, and they see the open Bibles. Can I join you? And what Bill would tell them is, you're free to join us, have our food, our drink, join us in our Bible study. But if you keep coming, you'll probably have a car accident. And it always happened. He says the people he would lead to Christ, one of their relatives would arrange an automobile accident and snuff him out. But he says the thing that really got to me is seeing these Muslim men come into his home and saying, don't turn me away. I'd rather have 2 weeks of the truth than a lifetime of lies. Let me come. And so he'd see numerous people come to Christ, and says the word would get out that he was bringing all these people to Christ. Now, as an American, they couldn't throw him in prison, but they could deport him. So he says, yeah, I'd be arrested by the secret police. They would question me, try to get stuff on me so they could throw other people into prison. And says they would deport me. But it says after a while, they let me come back. So he went there 4 times. Says he got deported 4 times. So, but it actually shows you what happens in a country where they pass these very severe laws. And I saw that myself when I went to Russia back in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Extremely oppressive laws forcing atheism on the population. When we actually talked to the individual Russians where no one was listening, I didn't meet any atheists. So, and that explains why there was such a tremendous movement towards Christianity once the laws got liberalized. And I've said this before in a class, a time will come when these really harsh laws against proselytizing for the Christian faith in the Islamic world will come down. We'll see it come down in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, etc. It will happen because of a promise in the Bible that the Lord will not return until his word has gone out to all the nations. And there are many nations of the world that have these extremely oppressive laws. Notice in Russia, the laws were not taken off the books until the Christian community was prepared to send in overnight 100,000 missionaries. If we weren't prepared to send in those 100,000 missionaries, Russia would have been overwhelmed by Hare Krishna, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Mormonism. And by the way, they sent in tens of thousands of cultic missionaries. I saw them. I was there. And I would run into these Russians, and they would say, what is Jehovah's Witness? What is Mormonism? Is it really true that Jesus came to North America? So these are the questions we got. But thankfully, there were more Christian missionaries in Russia than there were cultic missionaries. Well, I think God's waiting for the same thing to happen. And this time I think he's waiting for the Christian community to be ready to send in overnight 1 million missionaries. Because we're looking at a much bigger challenge than the Soviet Union of the late 1980s. So when we're ready, those laws will be taken off the books. So the good news is I see efforts actually to raise not 1 million, but getting close. Last time I was in China, Chinese church leaders, both in the Three Self Church and the Home Church movement, said, we're working together, which was something that amazed me, that Three Self Church pastors are working together with Home Church leaders to raise up 500,000 missionaries to send into the Islamic world. In the same way as Bill Considine, they said, you know, unlike you Americans, we have access to the Islamic world. They think we're their ally. And they're looking for technical skills. And so they're basically training Chinese Christians with the appropriate technical skills to basically do what Bill Considine did with those kinds of numbers. I don't think 500,000 is enough. It's going to take a lot more. But that's what I'm praying for. Because I want the Lord to return. I want him to return soon, but I know it can't happen until the whole world has had an opportunity here. So that will take place. I'm about 5 minutes over time, so let me close. Sorry, I didn't look at the clock.
Neither did I.
All right. Father in heaven, we do want to thank you for an amazing period of time in which we live. Lord, where opportunities are just around the corner, literally around the corner. To see you.